sound echoes just to be here. Food fire.
Quiet.
How was the space?
Well, that's true. That goes without saying.
But we were with my Rebbe for the Yamatova.
Good health and good spirits and strong, so that for us was wonderful. And then we're traveling around speaking in various places. So it was interesting and challenging.
How so?
Well, in one place, I spoke 6 times in 26 hours to a Beis Yaakov, to a yeshiva, to a group of completely non-religious Russians, to a Frum high-tech DNA company. This is unbelievable. In Chicago, there's a guy who owns a DNA marketing company. They make DNA and they market it. The laboratories and production are in Iowa. And he became a Baal Tshuva. And he set up the management in Chicago. And the whole management is from. He hired from people. He has a base medrash in the offices. These people I spoke to, they're all scientists. And they're all from. That was an interesting thing. And they're very argumentative. I didn't say half what I came to say. Everything I said, no. So that was fun. Who else did I speak to there? And you're going from one to the next, and they're so different from one another. Oh yes, and I spoke to a group of lawyers and businessmen downtown. So it was shifting gears like that was quite challenging. I spoke to the University of Michigan. I spoke to the University of Pennsylvania. So, hot shot students. At least they thought they were. Those are good schools. Those are good schools, and the students there are pretty good.
The crowd is at the universities mixed with religious and non-religious?
Yeah. In both cases. So, it was interesting and challenging. Starting at 3:10 and ending at 4. I'm going to change that a little bit because I want to give myself a few minutes to prepare for mental. I don't like these businesses. Walking into it, I need a few minutes to just prepare, so I'm going to stop 3 minutes early. Maybe I'll try to start 3 minutes early because I'm coming off another shear from 2 to 3, most of you. Well, for the next 10 weeks, until the middle of December, Yitzhak Hashem, I'll be going through the Derech Hashem, the Way of God by Mitzat, paragraph by paragraph. I'm interested in doing the Sefer, but I'm not committed to limiting our discussion to the Sefer. If other subjects come up, I'm happy to discuss them. I would like this to be a general review of important topics in Hashkafa, in Jewish philosophy. So I'll be reasonably liberal with tangential discussions. And if we use up so much of the time, then we come towards the end. I'll have to skip some parts of the Sefer. If you actually got hold of it, I mean,
we're all sitting down, so I guess it's okay. He actually got hold of the sefer and read some of it. That would probably be good. Would improve your understanding. And if you actually read some beforehand to prepare yourself, that would definitely improve your understanding, but I'm not going to presume that. I'm going to make the discussion here self-contained. And they have these little pocket things which cost about $2 or $3. You know, nobody complains, you know, beyond his resources. And it is a classic. So to get hold of it and to invest some time reading it is definitely worthwhile. Let me start with some introductory remarks about the author and about this particular book in the corpus of his works. Moshe Chaim Luzzatto lived in the beginning of the 18th century. He was born in Italy, was a child prodigy, who mastered all of the basic sources by his mid-teens, and who had a great penchant for Kabbalah. And his teachers, they were outstanding Kabbalistic teachers in Italy, and he was the student of two of them. Then he started writing works of Kabbalah, and he said that he had an angel that taught him. And this aroused a great deal of suspicion and opposition, so much so that the rabbinic authorities in Italy put him in cherem, which is sort of like excommunication. And so he left Italy and came to Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, he was appointed a Rosh Yeshiva. He taught. He also went to grind lenses, in part to support himself. And he wrote his major works in Amsterdam. Towards the end of his life, he moved to Israel, and he died in Israel. He was either 38 or 39 when he died. He is accepted by every branch of the Jewish nation, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Mishnagdim, Hasidim, the Mesila Sishorim, the Path of the Just, is studied in every yeshiva in the world. And he wrote works on virtually every subject. Maybe he doesn't have anything on practical halacha, but he has works on the methodology of learning Talmud, works on ethical improvement, works dealing directly with philosophical subjects, and many works dealing with Kabbalistic subjects. Some of them pure Kabbalah, the system of Kabbalah, some of them giving a Kabbalistic perspective on famous passages either in the Talmud or giving extended commentary on passages in the Zohar. Some of them giving a Kabbalistic background to everyday practice, the laws and customs that we follow. Something like 35 different works have come down to us. Others apparently have been lost. Now, I haven't read everything that he's written, but I've read a lot. And I've invested a considerable amount of time in studying Luzzatto. And the impression that I get from his works is something like this. Let's imagine that you're traveling, and you go to a museum, and in this museum there's a statue. Now you would like to describe this statue to the friends at home. Well, of course, if you write the description, it's not going to be very effective, but you have a camera. Of course, if you take a picture of a statue
All you're going to get is how the statue looks from one position. A statue has three dimensions. So half of it will be hidden from you. It's the back half that you can't see from that position. So here's what you could do. You could walk around the statue and take 10 snapshots at 36 degree intervals, then label them, for people who have trouble putting things in order, and say, look, here are 10 snapshots going all the way around. From the 10 snapshots, a person could picture pretty well what the thing looked like in the three-dimensional reality. My feeling is that each book that the Ramchal wrote is a snapshot. He had in mind a full reality. And this reality is too rich, or it's either he's too rich, period, or it was too rich for him to capture in one single coordinated description. So what he did is he took snapshots of it. How does that reality affect ethics? How does that reality affect study of Talmud? How does that reality affect logic? He has a book called Sefer HaHigayon, Principles of Logic. How does that reality affect our understanding of halacha and holidays and Shabbos and kashrus and things like that? How does that reality affect our understanding of mystical matters? So that each book is really only a snapshot from one point of view, which means that each book is missing a lot. Each book is missing a lot. Very often, you'll get into trouble in one book because he wasn't doing everything in that book. So he left things out. If you know what he wrote in other books, then you can use it to supplement and you can get a better picture. And that's what I will do in the cases where I'm able. Where here, if it seems that there's something missing, I will explain to you what he says in other books and we'll try to put it together to get a fuller picture. Now, having been a Talmudist and a Kabbalist and a very prolific author, what title could we give him which sums up his basic approach? Yeah, okay, good. I mean, but something descriptive, you know, something that, I have a belief here, and I'm encouraged by people, the fact that people other than I, with different background than I, agree with me. Basically, he's a philosopher. That's what he basically is. Because his method of attack, his interests, his scruples, are those of a philosopher. First of all, he wants everything to be organized. He wants to start with first principles and deduce everything and show how everything follows. Secondly, he cares about definitions of key concepts. Throughout Jewish literature, you hear the word olam used, world, especially in the Kabbalistic literature. There are four worlds, or more than four worlds, or earlier worlds, later worlds. The only writer that I know of who asked, what is a world? What is a world? How do you define what a world is? Is the Ramchal. And not only did he ask it, but having answered it, he said, now, in all the literature, you have a discussion of four worlds. According to my definition, one of them isn't really a world. It's just not true. It's just a word borrowed, but it's not literally correct. That's quite daring. Here's a person in the 18th century, will take a tradition that's thousands of years old, define a key concept, and then say, the way the tradition uses that concept in a particular case is really just a borrowed word, or it's an extended usage. It's not the literally essential usage of the term. That's characteristic of a philosopher. He wants the most fundamental principles, so much so that ideas that everybody else takes for granted, ideas that everybody else takes as a kind of assumption, he goes deeper and he shows how what they call assumptions can really be proven from a deeper perspective. So you have a verse that man is creating God's image. That's a verse in Genesis. We read it yesterday. Most most people, they're happy to say, look, the verse of Genesis, it's the principle of Judaism, black and white. Not for Ramchal. No, he has a deeper perspective from which that's only a consequence. That's not the starting point. That's only an application. He has a deeper principle from which that follows. As we'll see. Same thing with free will. Free will for most is an assumption, not for him. It's a consequence from a deeper perspective. An illustration of this is found in the introduction to the book, which I'm not going to go through in detail, but in the introduction to the book he says that when you analyze any subject, you should keep in mind four categories, so to speak, to think about with respect to a subject. They are part and whole, particular and general, object and property, cause and effect. So he says, if you are describing something that is a part, you ought to ask yourself, of what whole is it a part? In order to understand the thing well, you can't be content with it of itself. If it's part of a larger complex, you have to situate it within the larger complex. If it is a property, a characteristic, you have to ask, what object is it that has this characteristic? If it's a particular, then you should ask. It's a particular as an instance of what general idea? And if it is a cause, you should ask what its effect might be. And if it's an effect, you must ask what its cause might be. Now, if you've been listening carefully, you should hear that the four categories are not treated in the same way. Listen again and tell me which category is he not treating the same as the other three. When you're examining part and whole, if you have an item which is a part, ask yourself, what larger whole is it part of? If you have an item which is a particular, ask, of what general principle is it a particular? If you have an item which is a property, ask, of what object is it a property? And if you have something which is a cause, ask what might be its effect. And if you have something which is an effect, ask what might be its cause. Which category is being treated differently from the other three?
Cause and effect.
In what ways is it being treated differently?
It's working both ways.
He says you have to work both ways. In cause and effect alone, he says, if you have an item that's a cause, you have to ask what the effect might be. If you have an effect, something that's an effect, ask what the cause might be. In the other three categories, he only tells you to ask in one direction. Now why? What would be the logic in it? Part and whole, he says, if this item is part, ask what whole it comes from. He doesn't tell you to ask what? If it's a whole, what its parts are. Why not?
Because the whole is going to contain the parts.
Because if you really know the whole, then you automatically know the parts. The whole contains the parts. If it's a particular, ask what general idea it's an instance of. But if you can have a general idea and you understand the general idea well, then you will understand what its instances are, because the general idea contains the instance. If it's a property, you can ask what object it's a property of. But if you have the object, you understand the object well. To understand the object well means to understand all its properties. So in all three cases, those three categories, you have something that's included in something else. If you have the more inclusive thing, of course you have the thing that's included inside. Cause and effect are not like that. The cause does not include the effect, and the effect does not include the cause. Causes and effects are joined together externally, so to speak. If you didn't experience the world, you wouldn't have a clue what something causes or what something is the effect of. I don't know if you had this experiment in chemistry, but when we were in high school, chemistry teacher took pure sodium, which is a solid, and he made a whole long speech, and then he put a little bit in a glass of water and it exploded. That's what happens if you put sodium in water. Boy, we didn't expect that, you know, it's just little pebbles. Just little, you know, stuff. Doesn't happen when you put dirt in, or copper in, or iron in, or zinc in, or, you know, but the sodium, that's what happens. you hadn't seen it, you wouldn't have a clue. On the other hand, you have seen an explosion, you don't know what exploded. Could have been dynamite, could have been sodium in water, could have been all sorts of things. So cause and effect are related externally to one another. Now, that's the sign of an organized mind. A person who has all four categories and distinguishes the ones which are inclusive, the ones which aren't inclusive, this is the kind of mind you're giving. And when he writes about Kabbalah, he does exactly the same thing. He organizes it. He analyzes it. He gets the basic principles and the basic concepts, and from that he defines and deduces everything else. So I, having been trained in philosophy, in particular being trained in mathematical logic, for me this is delightful. That's probably what you're asleep. But for me this is delightful. It's exciting to find a person whose bent of mind is so similar to my own that he cares about the issues that bother me. In fact, my oldest son, who really is responsible for my studying Ramchal, he got in before I did, recommended that I read a certain work. I was reading this in an airplane, in a propeller airplane. It was a short hop in the United States. It was about, I guess, 18 years ago. I can picture it in my mind because, you know, my brain was on fire. He writes a paragraph with a point that says, oh, that's subject to an obvious objection. And the next paragraph he says, you're going to ask this objection. I said, how did you know? Who told you? You know, you're writing this 280 years ago. Right? It was paragraph after paragraph like that. So that led me to believe that, you know, here's a person who, you know, speak to me, given where I'm coming from. Anyway, that's who we have the privilege of starting to study. Any questions up to here? Okay, let's take a look at the first paragraph. Three lines, which will occupy us for a little while. Every Jewish person must... by the way, you can read it in the translation by Rabbi Kaplan, but I must tell you, with all honor to Rabbi Kaplan, who gave the Jewish world dozens of very important books, and he probably produced more than any five normal people in his lifetime. There are mistakes. Some fairly trivial, and one in the second chapter, which is egregious, and I will point it out to you. So you can read it in English, but if something bothers you, the first thing you should ask someone who knows Hebrew well is whether the translation is correct or not. Every Jewish person needs to believe and know. I might modify the word believe, but that's the way you're usually translated. Believe and know that there is a first being without beginning and without end, and he brought into existence and gives existence to everything that exists, and he is God. And let's go through piece by piece. Everyone has to believe and know. Believe and know. What's the difference between believing and knowing? Small bit of uncertainty when you believe. Knowing, you think, means that there's no uncertainty whatsoever.
Belief requires more faith than knowing.
Belief requires more faith than knowing. That sounds to me like you're agreeing with him.
Right, but I think that knowing means that there's no certainty.
Ah. He would allow some uncertainty when you say you know also. All right. Well, what, is there any other difference between believing and knowing? Can you imagine a person who's absolutely dead certain that something is true and yet you could not describe him as knowing it?
I mean, believe, and then you also have to study it all the time. You always have to be familiar with it. And knowing, you have to really know that person. You always have to be close to them.
Again, we're moving in a direction. Can you imagine a case where someone is dead certain of something and yet you cannot say he knows it?
Knowing be, like, prudent.
Okay. I want to come to that. But let me just take a very simple example. Suppose a person is dead certain about something and it's not true. I don't think we would say he knows it. You can't know things that aren't true. So surely just being dead certain is not enough for knowledge. Okay, but let's throw truth in. But now let's take a person who's dead certain about something that's true, but has no reason for it. Or he has a reason, but it's a lousy reason. He read it in the New York Times. And they just happened to get it right by accident. Or he flipped a coin and he decided to believe because the coin came up heads that it's going to rain tomorrow. And he's dead certain, and it turned out that it rained. Did he know it was going to rain? We say he had a lucky guess. It's not enough to be dead certain of something to know it. It's enough to believe it. You can believe it with some uncertainty or without any uncertainty. You can be spoken of as believing it. But if you don't have any reason for what you believe, it can't be called knowledge. So this could be why the Ramchal is not satisfied with saying believe, but says one should know. He's saying you got to have reason. Now he didn't invent this. Maimonides says exactly the same thing at the beginning of the Mishnah Torah. Chabad Lubavitcher says exactly the same thing. There are many before him and after who say that a person should have reason for what he believes, reason for all of his Jewish beliefs. But now the question will be asked the other way. If you're going to tell me I have to know, why say also that I have to believe? Could a person know something without believing it? I know it's true, I just don't believe it. Doesn't sound too clever. Surely, if you know it, you must believe it. And not only do you believe it, but you believe it very strongly, although I wouldn't necessarily put certainty in, and you have a reason for believing it.
You mean you know something in the sense that you just know it as an item of factual information or mm-hmm. piece of information versus you may or may not believe that it's so. You just know that, for example, if I make a claim of God and I say God exists, you know that there are those who claim that God exists, but you don't believe it.
But then do you know that God exists? Or you know that people say so? And then if you know that people so say so, I'll bet you believe that people say so. Whatever it is you say you know, presumably you have to believe. Now, I think here in Hebrew, yamin, la'amin, doesn't really mean to believe. La'amin means something more like to trust. To trust and to live in terms of something. To make something part of your life. To integrate it. Make it part of you. You know the story when the Jews came out of Egypt and Amalek attacked us. So Moses said to Joshua, raise an army and go fight. And they did. Moses climbed the mountain, and he was up there with Yoshua and Hur. And when Moses raised up his hands, the Jewish army was victorious. And when he lowered his hands, because he got tired, then the Amalekite army was victorious. And finally, they sat him on a rock, and Yoshua held up one hand, and Hur held up the other hand. And while his hands were up, it was still the sunset, the Jewish army finished the battle and was victorious. Now, the Torah describes it as follows. Vayehi yadav emuna ad bo hashamish. His hands were emuna until sunset. Emuna is the verb of is the noun of lahamin. Surely it doesn't mean faith or belief here. His hands were faith. His hands were belief. It just doesn't fit. But if you say his hands were faithful, the Jewish people needed them. His hands being up engineered their victories. However that works. And they didn't fail. They were faithful, reliable. They fulfilled their task. La'amin means to make something your own, to live in terms of it, to incorporate it into your life. Now, the Ramchal is saying that there are two things that a Jew has to do. He has to make it part of him, and he also has to know. You could make it part of you because your parents taught it to you. And just be brought up that way. No, that's not enough. One shouldn't be content with that. One also has to do an investigation to come to know. The Pasuk says, Yadata hayom v'ashivosa elavecha. You should know this day and you should place it on your heart. Those are two different things. Knowing is one thing, same verb that he uses here, and placing it on your heart is integrating it so that it becomes part of it. Okay, next. There is a first being without beginning, without end. Now let's think. First and without beginning. Are those the same? Does one imply the other? Or are they really two independent ideas? First and without beginning. Could something be first and yet have a beginning? Could something lack a beginning and not be first? Can we separate the ideas? Let's see. Could something be first and yet have a beginning? Huh? Fruits growing on trees. What's first?
The first fruit that grew on the tree.
Yeah.
That's beginning.
Ah, okay. But look at the first altogether. The first thing. First thing in existence.
First is the beginning.
Yeah, but so, no, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. Okay, so in other words, let's give everything a date. How old it is. An age. 27 years, 250 years. 14,000 years, I mean, you know, if you like big numbers. 125 million years. Everything gets an age. Now, this one could be 14 billion years, and nothing be as old as that. It's first, but it has a beginning. It has a particular finite age. So, you could be first and yet have a beginning. Now, the other way around. Imagine something that has no beginning. It goes back forever. Infinitely. Could it yet not be first? How? Okay. How? How could it not be first if it has no beginning?
Being separated from time.
If you're separated from time, I don't think you can talk about first anymore.
First in the sense that it's the only.
No, I mean first. Temporal. Could something be without beginning and yet not be first? Surely, if it has no beginning, if it goes back forever, you can't get something older than it, something that came before it, because there is no before. It goes back forever.
So why does he say that?
Oh, good. So I'm challenging you to think. There is an answer. Yes, it is possible to go back infinitely and yet not be first. It is possible. Because there might be two of them. There might be two. They go back forever. And then neither is first. First is only one. Can't be two things that are first. You know, in a race, if you get a tie, you don't have a winner. A winner. Now, this is not just an abstract possibility. Plato actually held such a position. Plato said, the creator, Plato believed in a creator, the creator goes back infinitely, forever, and so does the world. The creator has always been creating the world. As old as he is, the world is that old. Because he has always been creating it. So now you have two things that go back forever, the creator and the world. Then neither of them could be regarded as first.
But the creator was there before the world.
So you say, but Plato doesn't say that. Plato says, if you take time, time goes back forever. And going back forever, you have the creator. And at all times, the creator has been creating the world. Right? He's not talking about our creator, who's outside the world, right? So if that's the case, you got two things going back in the same way, then neither one is first. So Ramchal says, I'm talking about something without beginning, and first means nothing else is like that. That's another two words, yeah.
How I'm a little confused how you can even talk about first if there's nothing else after. Doesn't first imply that there's...
Surely are things that are after. You, for example.
Oh, you.
I mean, you came into existence this time around 20 years ago, right?
Just talking about first in terms of not just God, anything else after.
Anything with that's younger came later. He goes back without limit, goes back infinitely, And nothing else goes back infinitely, so he's without beginning and also first. Now, he says, same verb in two tenses. He brought into existence, past tense, and brings into existence, present tense, everything that exists. Why would he use the same verb twice, a past and a present? He brought into existence and brings into existence. By the way, our friend, Rabbi Kaplan here says, continues to sustain them. That does not do justice to the Hebrew. The Hebrew is the same verb twice.
Because God's constantly, every day, God's constantly creating.
Okay, so this is true. The present tense is literally true. God is constantly bringing the world into existence moment by moment. It doesn't just float along because it was here before and nobody squashed it yet. It's not just floating along. It needs to be propped up all the time. The example that I like is, you know what a Van de Graaff generator is? You know what static electricity is? That's what happens in the winter. You take off a piece of clothing and it crackles. Well, if you rub metal pieces against one another in a certain way, you create a lot of that electricity. So what they do is this. They have a giant wheel with loose pieces of metal, and then they have a big wooden frame with fixed pieces of metal, and as you turn this wheel around and the loose pieces rub against the fixed pieces, that generates a lot of static electricity. And then when they get enough of it, a spark jumps from one pole to another pole. And if it's big enough, the spark is quite impressive. In the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, they do this every day. They hold up a big oak board, and the electricity goes smashing through the oak board, which starts to smoke and flame, and all the kids become physicists. that's what it's designed to do. It's paid for by General Electric. Now, think about the spark. The spark jumping from pole to pole. As long as you turn the wheel, the spark will jump from pole to pole. If you stop turning the wheel, the spark disappears. The spark is there because the wheel is putting energy in. If you stop putting energy in, the spark disappears. The spark is like our world. Our world is that spark. God is putting energy in all the time. And that's why the world continues to exist. So that's why he says it in the present tense. Mamsi. He makes the world exist. Why should he say it in the past tense? Yes, because it started. Who said it? Because it had a beginning.
Yeah.
Right, because it started at a particular time. This process of creating, which goes on continuously, started at a particular time. Very good. That's the first thing that one has to know. That God is the one to whom one owes one's existence. I exist only because he makes me exist. He, on the other hand, is totally independent. He's totally independent. How do I know that? Given what we said, how do I know he's totally independent? Because he's first. If he's first, it means he was alone. If he was alone, there wasn't anything else that was making him, giving him his existence. So his existence is the only thing that existed alone, without help, without support, without any props. Everything else exists because he brought it into existence. He alone has independent existence. We all are dependent in our existence, dependent upon him. Okay, next three lines. See if we can finish six lines today. Also, a person has to know that this being, blessed be his name, his true existence, his essence, the nature of his being is not grasped by anything other than he. Only this is known about him, that he is he has no deficiencies, not missing anything, not lacking anything. But the nature of his existence is not
grasped at all. Now here, I think, is a place where you have to use what is written in other places, because you could easily ask, if we don't know anything about him, then how do we know that he is without deficiency, complete, perfect? How do we know that?
Rambam talks about this.
Correct. Correct. Good for you. The Rambam talks about this. It was true, where he talks about foreknowledge and free will. Yes, he does. That's exactly what I said. That's exactly what I was about to say, as a matter of fact. Maybe you'd like to finish the lecture. That's exactly right. In talking about foreknowledge and free will, Maimonides says this. How God knows the future, we cannot grasp. Because God's knowledge is not like our knowledge in any way, shape, or form. After all, when a person knows something, we say there's the person who knows, and there's the thing that he knows, and there's his knowing it. And those are three different things. George knows the Pythagorean theorem. So there's George who knows, and there's the Pythagorean theorem, which has been on the books for 2,500 years. And then there's George's mind, which has grasped that theorem. Those three things are different. There was a time when George didn't know. And now, and the theorem was there on the books, and he didn't know it. And now he has come to know the theorem. Other people also know the theorem. They don't know George. So there's George, and there's his knowledge, and there's the thing he knows. They're all three separate things. But says Maimonides, with God, it's not like that. Everything with God is the same. There are no distinctions. God, the knower, and the thing known, and the knowledge are all one. Something which we cannot grasp and understand and describe. For us, that's just meaningless terms. And therefore, we can't grasp God's knowledge at all. That's what Maimonides says. Now, there too, you could wonder about the way he describes it. You're telling me God knows, and then you're telling me it's impossible for us to understand how he knows. Indeed, the words that we use to talk about knowledge are wrong. They're wrong words. They only work for people. They don't work for God at all. Now, if that's so, then why say that he knows? You're using the words which you tell me we can't understand and can't apply to God. So why are you using it? The correct explanation, I believe, I heard this first from my eldest son, I think he put it well, is this. On the one hand, I cannot describe God as he is. Indeed, Maimonides right there says, just as you can't describe God's true nature, and he uses the same words that the Ramchal uses here. Ramchal often quotes Maimonides, which I should put in as a footnote, is very strange, because Ramchal is a Kabbalist. Maimonides didn't know anything about the Kabbalah. To find the Ramchal following Maimonides in structure, in organization, in terminology, and often even in thought, is quite a surprise. One would have expected him to follow Nachmanides, the great Kabbalist among the Rishonim. There's very little connection between the Ramchal and Nachmanides. Another indication that I told you that he's basically a philosopher. So Maimonides says, just as you can't grasp or describe God's essence, so you can't grasp or describe his knowledge. Okay, but then why call it knowledge? So the answer is this. When you speak about knowledge, or indeed almost anything else, you can talk about it on two levels. You can talk about what it is, and you can talk about what it does. This is what my son said. God has all the powers of knowledge, but he doesn't have them through knowledge. It's not knowledge that gives them to him. He's not missing any of the abilities that knowledge would give you. He hasn't got a weakness that way. He has all the abilities that knowledge will give you, but not through knowledge. It's not knowledge that gives it to him. It's something else that we cannot describe. So when Maimonides says he knows, what he means is he can do everything a knower can do. He has all the powers of a knower. But if you ask me, How does he have the powers of a knower? It's not by what we call knowledge. It's something else that we can't describe at all. But the crucial distinction is between what he is and what he does. That's a distinction Maimonides makes elsewhere. And I think that the same thing applies here, what the Ramchal is saying here. What he is, we cannot describe at all. But what he does, and in Ramchal you have an extra element, which we will talk about in the future, his will we can describe. The being that has the will we cannot describe. But his will we can describe, and what the will produces we can describe, and that is perfect. That is perfect without any deficiency whatsoever. But the being behind it, who has this will, who has these abilities, who does these things, is something that we cannot describe at all. That would make it come out consistent, and it's consistent with the things that he writes also. Now, let me expand on this in two ways, maybe that'll be enough for this hour. Why should God be beyond all description? Why should that be? In this, all Jewish sources agree. The Kabbalistic sources, the philosophical sources, Maimonides and the Kuzari. Zohar, all of them. Why should that be? So Maimonides, in a way, indicates an explanation which a non-Jewish philosopher thought he invented in the middle of the 20th century, named Gilbert Ryle. But really, it's in Maimonides' guide 900 years before him. Why should Rahab read Maimonides? No reason at all. And it works like this. You have words in English, words that describe things. Each word that describes something is attached to a category of things that it is designed to describe. Within that category, the word applies to some and not to others. Truly, falsely. The minute you take the word outside the category, what you get is nonsense. So, for example, this table is brown. It is brown, it's not green. Brown and green are words for describing physical objects. Brown is true of the table, and green is false of the table. What about the number six? Is the number six brown? Or green? Or yellow? Or purple? Magenta, chartreuse, turquoise. I know, it's transparent. No, that doesn't seem right either. Applying color terms to numbers just doesn't work. Color terms are designed to describe physical objects. That's the category they're attached to. Take them outside the category, what you get is nonsense. And it works backwards also. Some numbers are even as though numbers are odd. What is the table? Even or odd? Some numbers are prime, some are composite. Is the table prime or composite? Doesn't work. Prime, composite, even and odd are words for numbers. They're not words for physical objects. Each term that describes belongs to a category. Take it outside the category, what you get is nonsense. Now, God is outside all the categories. God is not a physical object, and God is not a number. God is not a property, and God is not a concept. And since he's outside all the categories, none of our descriptive terms applies to him. Our vocabulary, our language, our concepts have no relationship to God's nature. Maimonides goes so far as to say we can't even say God exists. Because what do we mean when we say exists? We mean tables, people, or numbers, or God isn't in any of those categories. So our word exists, which is attached to our categories, doesn't apply to it. Okay. But then, what about the thousands of descriptions of God that we have in our literature? Thousands. In the Tanakh, in the Midrash, in the Talmud, in the Siddur, wherever you look, there are descriptions of God. What are we going to do? Just throw out all that literature? Impossible. Now, I've given you the answer to this already. About 8 minutes ago.
What's the answer? What are we going to do with all those descriptions?
Describing his actions and stuff.
We're going to describe what he does, not what he is. That's how Maimonides could say he knows and then say we can't describe his knowledge as knowledge. So what did I say in the name of my son? That we're talking about his powers and what he does. The Ramchal, his will, but not what he is. All those descriptions have to be rewritten, re-understood as descriptions of what he does, not descriptions of what he is. And all the literature has to be read that way. This is a wonderful general idea. It generates a whole exercise. Take each supposed characteristic of God and rewrite it. This, if I, you know, if we were doing this in the university, I would give you this as a homework problem or as an essay exam. Take 10 supposed characteristics of God and translate them. Translate them into descriptions of what he does. God loves the Jewish people. That does not mean that when he pictures us, he wipes away a tear and sighs, you know, or his heart swells with pleasure and so on and so on. That's not what it means. Okay, what does it mean? It means that in history there will be a continuous favoritism for the Jewish people in the way in which someone who loves you will favor you. God loves justice. It means that the wicked will not indefinitely get away with evil. Eventually, we'll catch up with them. Eventually, they'll be punished for it. And so instead of talking about what God is, we talk about what God does. Now, the Ramchal, in one of his Kabbalistic works, on the first page, describes the spheros. Some of you have heard of the spheros. Spheros are just what God does. That's all it is. He says this black and white. They're just different categories of things that he does. And he gives a list of descriptions of God. And he says these are all spheros, meaning they're all descriptions of what he does. And one of them, he says explicitly, is God's knowledge. It means when you say God knows, as Maimonides says, you're not talking about what he is. You're only talking about what he does. And here's how to do it. And from this you can get a general pattern. What you say is, things happen in the way that a knower would produce them. It works like this. Pretend for a minute that God really knows. Now, ask yourself, if he really knows, what would he do? Now you get a whole description of all the things that he would do. All the ways in which things would work out in the world on the basis of his knowledge. Okay? Now, just cut out the first half. Wipe that out. And what you're left with is a description of all the things that will happen, which a knower would do. But I'm just now wiping out the first half. I'm not saying that he knows. That's a way in which you translate the characteristics of God into characteristics of what he does. And I don't know if you've ever studied philosophy. I'm not recommending it necessarily, but in philosophy of science, there's a whole school of thought that preaches that this is the way you should look at scientific theories. Just talk about what impact the theory has on observations. Don't think of the literal truth of the theory at all. This happens to be wrong in philosophy of science, but it's a parallel move intellectually to what we're talking about here. So what you end up with is descriptions of what he does, not descriptions of what he is. What he is literally beyond description. Okay.